This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today about nuclear issues with two guests, Alice Hurt and David Kraft, by telephone. Can both of you hear me? Hello, are you there? Alice? David? Let's see. We'll try to solve the technical problems here. We are going to
be Steve, I can hear you. Can you not hear me?
Ah, there. Now I could.
And yes, and this is Dave Kraft. I can hear you both.
Oh, great. Well, we're all on the air now. Great. We're talking about nuclear issues. Dave Kraft is with the Nuclear Energy Information Service. But let's start with Alice. Alice, how did you get interested in such issues as nuclear energy?
I think my interest was certainly cemented in April of 1986 with the explosion at the Chernobyl plant. It was after that that I, with that incident, I just pretty much thought, whatever I do, I got to do whatever I can to try to keep something like this from ever happening on the Great Lakes, in particular Lake Michigan.
Now, you live on the lake in Michigan, is that correct?
Yes.
That's where we're talking to you now.
Yes.
Well, what are some of the issues in Michigan in terms of the nuclear reactors there?
Well, the issue at the moment that I've been working on most recently is the fact that there is a plant that's about, it's located in South Haven, Michigan, right on the shore. I'm within 50 miles of that plant here. I live south of Holland, Michigan, and that's an older plant. It began operation in the early 70s. It's almost 40 years old, and the owners, Consumer Energy, are seeking a 20-year license extension for this plant. They would like the license now expires in 2011, but they want to operate it for another 20 years on top of that. And many of us here in Michigan say, no, you've operated long enough. You're an old plant. It's an old technology. It's time to close it down at the end of your license, and please don't renew this license. So that's the issue that we are really working on very fervently right now.
And who is the we?
At this point, we have well over 200,000 Michigan residents who have joined in this opposition. Michigan Environmental Council, which is an umbrella environmental group based in Lansing, Citizen Action, the Sierra Club of Michigan. I could name you 20 or 30 environmental groups in Michigan, practically everyone that you could think of, that are opposed to this relicensing.
And let's switch states for a minute or two with Dave Kraft in terms of what are the issues in Illinois in terms of reactors.
Well, your listeners may not be aware of the fact that they live in the most nuclear-dependent state in the country. Exelon Corporation, which is the nuclear utility there now, actually has 14 reactors, of which 11 are operating in Illinois, and they have additional reactors in Pennsylvania because of the merger that took place a few years ago. So they are the largest nuclear utility in the country. Among those reactors right now are a number of serious problems that we think need to be dealt with. The first is, and perhaps the most emergent, is taking place around the Braidwood reactor right now, where it's been reported that numerous leaks of radioactive tritium have occurred at the reactor site since 1998, and many of these went unreported to the local communities up until recently when the utility was exposed to have been engaged in this problem. A second major issue for the folks in Illinois, though, is a little further downstate, and that's at the site of the Clinton nuclear reactor, because Exelon has plans at some point to perhaps build a second reactor on site there. So for us right now, those are two of the critical issues facing the state. In the not-too-distant future, we may be looking at shipments of high-level radioactive waste moving through the state prematurely and in transportation casks that are not safe. And then the constant remaining issue for many of us is the fact that we have the world's busiest airport at O'Hare Field within literally 25 minutes flight of not only every reactor in Illinois, but even the three reactors on the west coast of Michigan that would affect Alice and her organizations. So in a post-911 world where our technology is both our savior and our weak point, the fact that, you know, terrorism is out there really is alarming to us, given the fact that so many reactors are operating so close to the world's busiest airport.
Now, the Clinton nuclear reactor is about, 40 miles from Champaign-Urbana, where this program originates at the University of Illinois campus in Champaign-Urbana.
Right.
Why is it of concern? I might mention that this is move-in weekend here for students coming to the University of Illinois, and many parents are now driving back to Chicago and the suburbs after having left their children here. Why should it be a concern that they're considering building a second reactor here at Clinton?
Well, any addition to the nuclear fleet of the United States is a big mistake. I don't care what reactor design they pick. I don't care where they put it, whether it's at Clinton or Kalamazoo or anywhere else. We believe that it's time for nuclear power to be responsibly phased out and replaced with appropriate renewable energy resources. And there are a number of reasons for that. But the other thing that people don't quite understand is we're not, and when I say we, I'm talking about groups like ours, groups like Alice's, we're not just trying to be alarmists about enormous accidents such as took place at Chernobyl or at Three Mile Island. We're talking about the day-to-day operation of these reactors where 24/7 they are releasing minute, perhaps, quantities of radiation into the air, into the water, into the surrounding environment. You have workers who are being exposed on the job at these plants. And now, after all this, after 50 years of a pretty much failed technology, a very expensive technology, and a technology that puts us at risk of great accident, we have a situation where Exxon doesn't get the message that we have to move away from nuclear, and they're going to put another 1,000 megawatt nuclear reactor on site there. We think it's an economic drag on the economy of Illinois. We think it's an environmental disaster because it increases the risks that we described before. And it's simply the wrong direction to go if you believe that we are heading into a greenhouse world. So for all these reasons, the Clinton second reactor is a huge mistake, and we are opposing it.
And, Steve, I might also add to what Dave is just saying, that the issue of nuclear waste, that is a problem that has never been solved in this country. It's really never been solved anywhere. We have radioactive waste, high-level radioactive waste, piled up on the lake shore right at the Palisades plant, 150 yards from the water's edge, 29 enormous casks. And with Palisades, you know, they're going to do 20 more years of producing more waste that there is no place to go with. No one wants it. It makes no sense.
What has happened to the plans for disposing or at least trying to securely encapsulate the waste from nuclear energy plants?
In glass. Encapsulate it in, I mean, it is put now into where there's an excess when they cannot, when the pools, the fuel pools at the reactor sites are full, they are now putting it into what they call dry cask storage, which are huge concrete casks. That is what's being done.
And is there still plans to ship it to Yucca Mountain, or has that all been scrapped?
Well, Yucca Mountain has pretty much come to a standstill at this point.
Maybe we should describe what Yucca Mountain is for your
listeners. Yes, please do.
It's a, Dave, you can help me here.
Sure.
It's a Native American sacred land in Nevada, and it's a mountain that has been picked. How many years ago was that site picked? Maybe 20 years ago?
At least.
And it was really chosen because Nevada really didn't have very much political say in the whole matter because it's not a very populated state. It was not chosen because it is the best place, if there is a good place, to put radioactive waste. And they've been working on it and spending millions and millions of dollars. I don't even know what the figure is now.
It's currently up to $8 billion have been spent on the site.
But most recently, there have been reports of really falsification of reports by the scientists. They're working on this site. They have run into innumerable problems, one of them being that they really cannot figure out how to contain the water, the radioactive water that would leak from the mountain eventually, how they would keep that from leaking out into the groundwater. The people in Nevada don't want it. The Native American people don't want it. It is, they are supposed to isolate this material, this radioactive waste, from the environment for supposedly 10,000 years, whereas it really reaches its peak amount of radioactivity in 350,000 years. It's not something that can be easily separated from people and animals, and no one really knows how to do this.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our guest here on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the host for the program, and I'm talking by phone with Alice Hurt in Michigan and with David Kraft. You're in Chicago, right, David?
Yes.
And Dave's with the Nuclear Energy Information Service. And this is a live program every Sunday here on WILL. If listeners would like to take part in the conversation, we do encourage you to give us a call. Anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several local lines you can reach by punching in 333-9455. Well, let's continue with our discussion. I see we have a caller already on line four. You're on the air with our guest. Go right ahead.
Thank you. A very relevant topic. I live about 37 miles, I believe as a crow would fly, from the Clinton nuclear power plant. I have two questions. If there were a meltdown at Clinton, how far out in approximate number of miles would be directly affected? And do you have any time frame for the proposed building of a second nuclear reactor at Clinton?
All right. In response to the first question, predicting what would happen in an accident is very difficult because there's so many variables involved. Everything from the current weather conditions that are happening the day of the accident, the time of day that it's happening, the nature of the accident itself, all has an effect on how far the plume would extend, what would be in the plume, how rapidly it would disperse, and that sort of thing. Now, the one, of course, sensational example we have of it, what the industry euphemistically describes as a rapid disassembly, is the Chernobyl reactor. And in that case, because of the unique design of the reactor, it literally did blow up. You did not have an atomic explosion like a nuclear bomb, but you had an incredibly powerful explosion followed by a fire, which literally distributed, some estimates say, as much as 60 to 70% of the entire radioactive core around the planet. And I mean the whole planet. So that's a pretty big plume. Now, I would also point out that the organization Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Chicago chapter in particular, has been raising money to conduct computer simulations of medical and health consequences in the case of accidents, and they've picked a couple of Illinois nuclear reactors as their first projects. I've seen the simulation for the Braidwood nuclear plant, and given certain conditions that were programmed into this this computer run, the plume extended far into Indiana and up to Chicago, and in some cases it actually reached the Wisconsin border. Given the notion of what the prevailing winds were, whether it was a day where it was raining or not, I don't recall. So it's hard to really say for Clinton how far away. I would say that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission only mandates that Exelon and the nuclear utilities plan for emergencies in a 10-mile radius around the plant. We do know that at Chernobyl, the evacuation that occurred of over 400,000 people took place in a zone roughly 18 miles in diameter. So we think we're really underplanned in terms of the response.
What about the timetable for the second nuclear reactor? Is that something that's probably 10, 20 years away?
Well, it depends there, too. They're in the preliminary stages now of conducting what's called an early site permit. And this is the very first phase of the regulatory process where literally they're just saying, we want to reserve this piece of real estate for the future just in case we want to build a reactor. We expect a final decision on that probably within the next 6 months, and then that might have to be litigated and appealed. Once you move beyond that, then the utility may apply for a formal license to construct the reactor and eventually to operate it. That whole process could drag on for another 2-3 years. And then finally, once you get to the point of issuing a final building license and an operating license, it's going to take at least 4 to 5 more years for the utility to actually construct the reactor. Now, there's one little wild card in all of this, and that is that the Bush-Cheney administration, and which are strong allies of nuclear power and the nuclear industry, are trying to push legislation through even as we speak, which would fast-track a lot of this process. It would, in a sense, minimize public input, getting questions, discovery, being able to appeal and slow down the process so it could be properly examined. So that's the only way that you would see a change in the situation, is if politics interferes to make it go faster. It has nothing to do with science, has nothing to do with ecology or the environment, has to do with politics.
Could I make one more comment, just
sure.
About something else? I don't know, you probably don't remember this, but I remember in the early 80s, 60 Minutes visited the Clinton plant, and they found out that there were cost overruns of about $5 billion. And my second thought is, why don't we ever emphasize conservation? Because as much as we waste, I think we could much easily conserve without doing damage to anyone's standard of living. Thank you.
Yes.
Well, Clinton is very unique in the sense that at one point it was generating probably the costliest per kilowatt-hour electricity in the state of Illinois because of those overruns. I have an interesting quote in my files. I wish I had thought to dig it out. The former chairman of the board of Illinois Power, which had built Clinton 1, when he finally gave up on building the second Clinton reactor back in the 1980s, he said, we're pulling the plug on the second one, and if I knew then what I knew now about the first one, we wouldn't have built that one either.
We have a couple other callers waiting. Let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guests, Dave Kraft and Alice Hurt.
Hi. I was wondering, I heard your discussion a little bit just now, but I was wondering what you see as alternatives for nuclear power.
Alice, you want to take that?
I wanted to say one thing kind of in relation to what the last caller just said about energy efficiency. Energy efficiency improvements are 7 times more effective at reducing greenhouse gases per dollar than nuclear power is. Wind energy is one of the fastest growing sources of electricity that we are experiencing. Just recently, the Department of Energy estimated that here in Michigan, that there's 16,000 megawatts of wind power potential just here in Michigan, which is a number which is 20 times the amount that Palisades, which is a 798 megawatt plant, produces. So renewables are certainly out there, and it seems like they make more sense to me because they're more labor-intensive. They create a lot more jobs than these huge facilities that a nuclear facility creates. And we don't tie up as much of our money in building these plants. A new plant is probably around $4 billion, and it takes maybe 7 to 10 years to build.
Dave, do you want to respond to that too?
Well, yes, and particularly in Illinois' case, where Governor Blagojevich had attempted to enact what's called a renewable portfolio standard, this would have required utilities to allocate a portion of their generation and mandate that it be done by renewable energy. Exelon fought that, which is really interesting. It's funny, you know, anti-nuke people like Alice and I are often referred to as Luddites, yet here's an industry that is embracing a 19th century technology, which is literally, you know, boiling water to make steam to produce electricity as we enter the 21st century. As you get into a global warming world, you are going to need to get electricity in ways that have nothing to do with steam and water. And you can't escape it if you have a nuclear power plant. So who are the real Luddites here? But it's actually the nuclear industry, because they're embracing an old, expensive, dangerous technology when it's been proven that the renewables are there today. There are no technological barriers. The only barriers that exist are political, number one, and economies of scale, number two, which in essence are manipulated by utility executives who run nuclear plants. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that we don't have renewable energy. It's not a corporate choice. They've engineered it that way.
In order to really address global warming with nuclear power, you would need at least 1,500 to 2,000 more nuclear plants built. That would be like one every 2 weeks for the next 60 years.
Caller, did you want to follow up from your first question?
Yes, I did. The trouble with most of the renewable technologies is that they're not dispatchable. So for a power producer, it's very difficult to use them because, especially, you know, photovoltaic solar cells are the ones that are well known that produce power when the sun is up. What do you do when it's dark? What do you do when the wind isn't blowing? In terms of the price, you referred to $4 billion to build a nuclear power plant, but that's a 4-billion-watt power plant. That's just about the same price per watt that you pay for wind power today.
Well, the issue with intermittent renewables is actually a red herring kind of thing. It first of all assumes that the kind of electrical distribution system we have set up now is the optimal one, and that clearly is not the case, shown several years ago by the blackouts that wiped out a third of the country and part of Canada. What we're looking at is an old, dilapidated transmission and distribution system, which are supplied by very large central generating plants. And the real question to be asked as we move forward is that the kind of system that best serves society at any time, first of all, and then secondly, is that the kind of system that can optimally serve society in a global warming world? And the answer is clearly no to that question. So we're not just saying no nukes, and we're not even just saying we need conservation, efficiency, and renewables. What we are saying is it's time, folks, to get out of the box with our thinking, and we literally have to recreate the way we distribute this kind of power as well. Now, what this means is you'd be much more secure, you'd have a much more reliable system if it were decentralized, if it best use the local opportunities for energy production, which, by the way, in Illinois, being an agriculture state, we are vastly underutilizing the biomass potential of the state, let alone the wind potential and the solar potential. Now, nuclear reactors at night do things like pump water uphill, and then during the day when the power is expensive, they open the floodgates and let the water drain downhill to turn turbines. You can't tell me that you couldn't do the same thing with a solar plant or a wind plant during their optimal times and then use the power in the same way later on when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow.
But most of your answers are incorrect. I mean, you can't, first of all, nuclear power plants don't pump water. They simply turn themselves up or they're turned up or down.
No, they don't pump the water, but they generate the electricity that operates the pumps that do that.
But that's not how the nuclear power plant meets load demand. You pull control rods out or push them in to meet load demand. Whereas renewable energy, yes, you can pump water, but that's a very inefficient process. It's very difficult to store the renewable energy.
Right, and we're not saying that those would be the only mechanisms at play. You'd have a system which would be diversified enough to cover the bases when the sun doesn't shine, as you point out, and you certainly wouldn't want to site windmills in places that are wind deficient.
But
what I'm saying is we have to redesign the system.
How do you meet the power need when the sun isn't shining or when the wind isn't blowing?
Well, can you point to some times when that has happened in Illinois? I'm not so sure that actually really happens. And there, too, you do have a grid system that is there. Even the interrelated distributed grid system would be able to handle that kind of load shifting. They do load shifting now on the base load plants.
It certainly is a concern. This is why the nuclear power industry is so favored by the electric power utilities, is because it's not easy to do what you say.
Well, perhaps not under the current system, but that's part of the planning that we're asking for here, too.
I think we take your point, caller. We do have others waiting, but thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Let's go to line number two. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go right ahead.
My understanding of the Chernobyl accident is that the sarcophagus that surrounded the reactor was completely inadequate, and that the accident occurred, and that the explosion affected the environment primarily because of that. My understanding is that here in the United States, we do not use that kind of a surrounding structure, and that an explosion could be contained. I just appreciate your thoughts on that.
I think you're right that the design of that plant is certainly different than the designs of U.S. plants. The containment, I think, is what you're speaking about, is the containment. It is true that it is different, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission itself recognizes that there is a potential, certainly for catastrophic accidents at plants here in the United States. They don't just say those kind of accidents cannot happen here. There are factors which create those situations, and human error is one of them. But like it say the Palisades plant here in Michigan, it's a really old plant and it's very embrittled. The reactor vessel itself is very embrittled. It's like a hot water coffee container beaker that you would put under cold water, and it could crack. In 1982, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission estimated itself that if there were a catastrophic accident, that there would be, in 1982 dollars, $52 billion of damage, 10,000 latent cancer deaths. That was in 1982. These kind of things can happen here.
I would add a piece there, too, that they did calculations as to what exactly could be estimated the explosive force was at Chernobyl. And they were shocked to find out that there are a number of U.S. reactors with a totally different kind of design than Chernobyl, which also would not have been able to withstand that level of explosive force that occurred at the Chernobyl accident. Some of those are the old Mark I General Electric boiling water reactors, which you find at Dresden and at Quad Cities on the Mississippi River. So we have our own unique vulnerabilities, as Alice is pointing out, in our plants. And should any of those result in explosive forces approaching what has already occurred in the nuclear industry, there's no guarantee that our reactor containments would be adequate to hold the radioactive inventories in.
And in the unfortunate incidence of a terrorist attack of some kind on a plant or on the fuel pools, there was a recent study about what would happen if there were such a fire, an accident in a fuel pool, and there would be thousands of deaths possibly downwind from that reactor site.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon about nuclear issues, particularly nuclear energy, with Alice Hurt in Michigan and with David Kraft in Chicago, Illinois, from the Nuclear Energy Information Service. Could you just tell me quickly how people could get get more information? Is there a website that you maintain?
I would like to suggest one. There is a group in Washington, D.C. that works very closely with local groups across the country. They're a group that's working with us. They're called Nuclear Information and Resource Service. If you just type in NIRS.org, it's a great website, and you can find out what's going on in a number of reactors across the country, and in particular at Palisades, if you're interested in that reactor. But it's a really good website to go to. And David, you can probably suggest some.
Well, of course, folks in Illinois can reach us, and we have a very simple website also. It's just our acronym. It's NEIS.org. And on there, you'll have our email address and telephone and address contacts as well. There are other organizations that both Alice is groups and ours have worked with over the years, including Public Citizen, which is in Washington, D.C. We've also worked with an organization called the Union of Concerned Scientists, which have offices both in Washington, D.C. and in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and have been very helpful on many of the technical issues.
And Public Citizen.
Yes, right, Public Citizen. And last but not least, I would mention a group that a lot of people don't know too much about, but it's really an important group, and that's the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, IEER, in Tacoma Park, Maryland. We actually have their director coming to the Midwest in October for a series of events in Wisconsin and Illinois. And they have also done a lot of scientific analysis of these issues with reactors, radioactive waste, and renewable energy.
For listeners keeping the faith this afternoon who'd like to be on the program by asking a question or making a comment via your telephone, anywhere the program is heard, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL for a toll-free call, including if you're listening on the Internet. And if you've missed part of this program and would like to hear it or hear previous programs, they are archived at the WILL website. That's WILL.UIUC.edu. And then go to AM 580 and then Keeping the Faith, and you'll see a list of the programs. You can, of course, hear that live here that way, too, if you're outside the listening area. People in Champaign-Urbana may call with a comment or question at 333-9455. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the host for the program. Next week, I'll be talking with Mike Kozar about Communiversity, a local program here at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. In September, Tim Holder will be our guest September 10. He's an Episcopal priest at Trinity Episcopal Church in the South Bronx of New York City, and he's developed a hip-hop mass. So we'll have an interesting discussion on September 10 via phone with Father Tim Holder. September 17, Reverend Ignacio Costuera, a Methodist pastor who's the national chaplain for Planned Parenthood, will be in our studio as our guest. That's September 17. On September 24, Elihu Smith from the local Zen Buddhist community will be talking about hateful, violent religions. Those are some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith, 5 o'clock Central Time here on WILL AM 580, a radio service of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Well, let me take just a moment to mention that support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA, which is the oldest student organization on this campus. It was started in 1873, and since that time has been developing student leaders by providing opportunities for social action and community service. We have many lecture programs and service projects, tutoring the public schools, alternative spring break, fall break, winter break, summer break, service opportunities for students. We have literally hundreds of students involved in our programs, and we're supported by the gifts of people who care about continuing this University Y that doesn't have a pool or a gym, but has all these projects for students. One of our big projects is actually happening this week, and that's a huge recycling program. We think the biggest in downstate Illinois, where we literally fill the university stock pavilion with things that students might ordinarily throw away when they leave this campus in the spring. We save them, put them on big semi-trailer trucks, and we have furniture and kitchenwares and bicycles and all sorts of things. And our sale of all those things now back to new students, and particularly new international students and people in the community, starts this Thursday. From 2 till 9 this Thursday, August 24, at the Stock Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue in Urbana. It's just a couple blocks east of Memorial Stadium, football stadium for the university. It'll last Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. The hours Thursday are 2 to 9 in the afternoon, Friday from 10 in the morning till 6 at night, and Saturday from 9 until 12. $2 admission on Thursday, free admission Friday. Saturday is free, plus it'll be a $3 bag sale. Anything you can put in a bag for $3 on Saturday. So we hope to recycle just lots and lots of stuff, make a little money for the Y, and keep trash out of the waste stream. So that's...
So I'd like to add a personal note.
Oh, sure, please do.
The Y holds a very special place at the University of Illinois in my heart, because as a young student there in the 60s, the early 60s. I was one of those people that went to the Y to become politically active and involved, and in fact, that's where I met my husband.
And you were involved, as I remember,
at that time in the Civil Rights. Yep.
And we're still facing some of those same issues today.
Yep.
Well, thank you for that testimonial.
Thank you for inviting me to be on.
Sure. Well, we're talking with Alice Hurt in Holland, Michigan, and with Dave Kraft in Chicago, Illinois. Dave is with the Nuclear Energy Information Service in Illinois. If you'd like to find out more about that group, go to their website, neis.org. And we're talking about nuclear energy issues. And, of course, these days that also involves, as you've already mentioned, worries about terrorist threats to these nuclear power facilities. Now, we've not had a major world accident that I know of with reactors where that's happened, but why are you worried about it?
Jay, could I jump in for a minute? I'm concerned since 9/11 that this issue has not really been taken seriously in this country. And one of the things that really bothers me is that in these relicensing proceedings, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does not allow that issue to be brought forward. We have tried any number of ways as citizens here in Michigan to say, let's consider this as an issue in relicensing this plant. You now have all this high-level waste sitting on the beach. You have fuel pools that are full of high-level waste. But they have just shaken their heads and said, nope, that's out of scope. It's too remote to consider. We won't allow you to bring that forward as an issue. And at this point, I have to say, they have already relicensed at least 40 reactors in this country, most very recently. So they are not taking this issue seriously. It just two or three years ago, 27 attorney generals across the country, and our governor now, Governor Granholm, was one of those attorney generals, signed a letter saying, we are concerned about the issue of terrorism at nuclear power plants, and we don't feel that this issue has been addressed seriously, and that we don't feel enough measures have been taken to really address this issue. We are we're concerned about terrorism. We're concerned about what could happen, and we're concerned about this high-level waste sitting on the beach.
Dave Kraft, what about in Illinois?
Well, I would certainly share every sentiment that Alice just mentioned. People need to understand that a nuclear power plant is a World Trade Center with 1,000 Hiroshima's worth of radiation stored inside. That's how it has to be viewed in a post-9/11 world. Now, has the nuclear industry made some strides? Has the nuclear regulatory made some strides in improving reactor security since 9/11? The answer is yes. We have to acknowledge that. That's the good news. The bad news is the progress they've made has shown just how woeful and inadequate their attention the previous 15 or 20 years to the issue was given by them. Certainly, they've done things like hired more guards, and they've closed the gates at places like Zion, Illinois, and have staff in the guardhouses, whereas before they didn't. So I guess you can call that progress. The question really remains is, in a post-9/11 world, could whatever it is they've done so far really repel a group of determined intruders, which is the phrase they use, a la the 19 people who, for example, are accused of doing the World trade attacks? And the answer is clearly no. By definition, the NRC, the federal regulators, refused to acknowledge that perhaps these individuals could get weapons on the black market that are different from the ones that they list in their regulations. They, in the past, have excluded the possibility that the terrorists could get in some sort of a waterborne assault, which is ridiculous because every reactor has to be sited either on a river, lake, or an ocean. So to not take that into consideration is the height of insanity, really. It's denying reality. And then finally, you know, most egregiously, there is absolutely no attention given to either accidental or intentional crashes of commercial airliners or military aircraft into the reactors or the spent fuel pools. So, you know, the reality is that these folks just don't have a plan together that really safeguard any reactors, not just Illinois reactors, but any reactors in this country.
One positive small thing, kind of small, that happened just a couple of months ago is that a group in California, the Mothers for Peace of San Luis Obispo, and along with a Sierra Club chapter in the Ninth Circuit Court in California, there was a ruling that that terrorism must be considered in a relicensing process. And that was a very exciting thing for us because we were like, wow, finally somebody is looking at this and saying, yes, it needs to be considered. And so we are trying to get them here in Michigan to say we have filed a filing on this maybe a month ago, but we have still not heard back. But we have said we want to have this considered in the relicensing of the Palisades nuclear plant.
To ask a question or make a comment or express another point of view, do give us a call. This is a live program on WILL. Call 1-800-222-9455 for a toll-free call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. You mentioned earlier the issues of global warming. Isn't nuclear energy one of the better ways to produce power in terms of its immediate effect on the globe?
Actually, not. And I must say that emphatically, and I'm sure Alice will chime in on this one as well. You couldn't pick a worse energy resource to fight global warming. And the reason is that it has seductively convinced people that because in the process of generating the electricity, it doesn't give off greenhouse gases, and therefore that makes it a good candidate. But when you really get down to the details of what nuclear power is about, nuclear power fails miserably on every critical test. The first test, I think Alice mentioned earlier, is in order to get the number of reactors online that would be required to really make a meaningful dent in reversing global warming. I've seen estimates as high as 7,000 to 8,000 reactors worldwide would have to be in play. We only have 420 on the planet right now. Now, Alice's number earlier was somewhere between, 15 and 2,000 is what you said, Alice?
Mm-hmm.
When you take a look at what that means, you're talking about building an entire new nuclear facility every 3 days or so for about the next 30, 40 years, at a cost of anywhere from $2.5 to $4 billion. Worldwide, that calculates out to somewhere on the order of over $20 trillion of just investment capital would be required just to build the plants, not get the fuel for it, not safeguard it, not protect it from terrorists, not make sure there aren't any more accidents, which, of course, probability says there would be, because the more reactors you have, the more likely you're going to have an accident. So,
The older the plants get, the more likely there are accidents.
Right. Now, we had a very interesting occurrence take place last summer, and in 1988 in Illinois. And that is in very, very hot weather conditions, which I guess you could say are the ramp up to what a global warming world would be like. When the reactors were needed the most on those very hot days, particularly like we had a few weeks ago when we were in the 100-degree range, some reactors had to cut back on their power output because the hot water they were discharging into the river systems as a result of making the steam was exceeding Environmental Protection Agency standards. if you exceed the standards for a long enough period of time, you literally kill the river system downstream. So in a global warming world, number one, you're either going to have to choose between more nukes cranking out hotter water and killing off your whole river system or your lake system, depending on where you site the reactors, or you're going to have to do without the nuclear power when you need it the most on those hot 100-degree days, which could be every other day in a global warming world. Who knows? So it's just not, they're not suited well
and
for operating.
And to add to that, David, the warmer the water becomes in Lake Michigan and other bodies of water from global warming, they can't cool the reactor in the way that they should. It becomes more than an economic issue. It's also a safety issue.
That's right.
There were plants closed in Germany.
You had the Cook reactor down because
yeah,
of
here,
overheating.
But also in Europe they were closed down because of the temperature from global warming or from the temperature rise in the bodies of water. They could not keep the plants running.
We have a caller waiting on line number 4, our toll-free line. Go right ahead. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi. This is Southern Illinois speaking.
Whoa.
Hi. this is...
How Southern?
This is a fantastic topic, since right near here they're talking about opening up a new coal mine. And on the good side, though, with the new clean coal stuff, but that's all BS, too. Here's the thing. I heard Ralph Nader, 15 years ago, talk about how nuclear power was the biggest swindle in American history. The cost of the building, maintenance, and insurance just pales to any other public swindle in the utility business or whatever. And for just a fraction of the money, they could literally almost give away solar panels to people. I mean, you know, and that's my comment. Thank you very much.
Where are you in Southern Illinois?
Oh, we're in, in relation to Centralia, we're about 100 miles south of, Springfield. We're about 100 miles due south of Springfield.
Okay, so. I come from farther south than that in Illinois.
Uh-huh.
Most people don't think there is a Southern Illinois.
Yeah. Well, they're just getting ready to open up a coal mine within about 50 miles of here. That's it's a swindle too. Our county was going to lease the coal. It's to a Kentucky coal operation. They were going to lease it, and then they defaulted on their lease hold agreement. Get this, and then the county went back and just sold it to them, which I'm sure. I don't know the details, but just knowing how that kind of business works, the county's getting a fraction of what it would have gotten from a lease. Plus, I don't know, but I can just guess that there aren't the kind of backup environmental restoration guarantees, and then the, you know, just et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I just want to make the comment that for the cost of a nuclear power plant, they could literally give away solar panels to people.
There really is no way that they could do this, build these plants, and keep it going without huge subsidies.
Yeah.
This industry has been subsidized to the hilt.
Ralph Nader made that real clear. It's the biggest, it's one of the biggest swindles, the nuclear power industry itself. And he was specifically talking about the California, the building of the Rancho Seco and the other one in California, that it was a gigantic, gigantic swindle, and it's still going on.
And look at your homeowner's policy. You are not protected against a nuclear power plant accident.
They can't.
None of us are.
They have to get the government to come in and insure it, and then that's all I really have to say, that just what a swindle. And thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There is one other way of phrasing exactly what your caller just mentioned, and I think it's an accurate description, is nuclear power is probably the biggest socialist energy scheme in play right now when you get down to it. All the free marketeers in these utilities, you know, are screaming bloody murder. They want government off their backs and smaller government and get out of our business until it's time to insure the reactors. Then they need a federal guarantee that claims against the utility in case of a nuclear accident that they would cause should be indemnified by the federal treasury, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. A
radioactive waste issue is the other one, Yucca Mountain. Who's paying for the Yucca Mountain? The Department of Energy. Who's the Department of Energy? Big government. So these free marketeer fakes at the utility level, both in the nuclear industry and in the coal industry, are really socialists in disguise. you know, if there's any big expenditure, the public has to pick up the tab. If there are any big profits, that's got to go to our shareholders. So it's a real double standard in play here.
Now, what about the whole issue of nuclear weapons? We've not talked about that at all. We've only talked about nuclear energy, but I know some of our listeners are equally concerned about the whole issue of is there any way to get rid of the nuclear weapons that the U.S. is the leader in stockpiling?
Well, just in relation to nuclear energy as an issue, on the average, each power plant, a large plant like Palisades, produces somewhere between 400 and 500 pounds of plutonium a year. That's contained within the waste. It amounts to 1% of the total waste, but it's a lot of plutonium. The Bush administration is very keen now to push the idea of reprocessing, which means taking that waste and gleaning the plutonium out of the waste. We are very concerned that this is a proliferation issue, that it will create many more problems in terms of someone being able to retrieve that plutonium and make a bomb. It only takes 10 pounds of plutonium to make a Nagasaki-type bomb.
If you take a look around the planet, too, the countries that wanted commercial nuclear power were ultimately the ones that at some point wanted nuclear weapons as well. It's really a mirror image situation in spite of the fake separation that has been mm-hmm. portrayed in the United States between nuclear weapons on the one hand and nuclear power on the other, certainly after the Eisenhower-Adams for Peace program. We're seeing more and more that these two issues are growing closer together. The waste streams are very similar, and in some cases are being dealt with by the same agencies with the same kinds of technologies. We're also finding for the first time in our history, a commercial nuclear power plant in the United States is producing materials for weapons use. And that's the tritium that's being produced by a couple of TVA reactors down in Tennessee. This is the first time this has occurred in the 50-year history of the United States, which really shows that the main reason to keep a commercial nuclear power industry going is so that they can continue, you know, the twin sister, which is the nuclear weapons program, because the two really are hand in glove.
We have another caller on our toll-free line, line 4. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hi. I think he's quite right. The atom bomb is linked to the used as an the nuclear energy is used an excuse to produce the atom bomb, but we don't need the atom bomb either.
You're here.
That's right.
Can you say that again, please, so you're listening?
Yeah. We want to get rid of the nuclear bomb. We have enough conventional weapons anyhow, so yeah. But it's purely profit for some of the big industries and the big military industries and the also Boeing and Westinghouse and perhaps some other companies make a lot of money off of nuclear power plants. And that's the reason I think we keep it going after the nuclear link to the atom bomb. But also some countries, Sweden, is using renewables to replace nuclear power by 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And some other states, Belgium either, doesn't like nuclear. So some countries are getting wise. And the U.S. subsidizes the nuclear power business so much, too, just like it does the oil industry. And, of course, those two industries, oil and nuclear are linked. Probably all the energy business is linked so much today. We have such big mergers nowadays. But so we should get, and there are greenhouse gas emissions, which you may have mentioned already, connected with nuclear power all the way from mining of uranium.
That's right.
Nuclear isn't going to give us complete, even if we could have all the nuclear power plants of the 8,000, I think, that you mentioned. We still want to get clean the environment.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comment. Did you have a response, Dave?
It's a long process from the mining of the uranium to the milling it's a tremendously long fuel cycle. And within that cycle, there are carbon emissions all along the way, and plus radioactive emissions. But they like to just talk about it as if at the end, product that at the power plant that they're not putting out emissions, but you have to look at the whole fuel cycle. The caller is absolutely right.
And Dave, did you have a comment as well?
She mentioned one point which I thought was important for Illinois in particular, and that was that Sweden has, for example, decided to replace nuclear with renewables. I know for a fact, I just spent the last 3 years on and off in Germany, they're doing the same thing there. Denmark gets a considerable portion of its electricity from wind power. The point I made earlier that the technology of renewables is there, that there are no technological barriers anymore, I think has been demonstrated amply around the world. So what is the barrier? The barrier is the lack of market share for the renewable energy, meaning that if a 1,000-megawatt reactor is built at Clinton 2, Exelon will then make the claim that, oh, the market is glutted with electricity. We don't need to build any more renewables. And in essence, what you have here is this kind of crazy game going on of self-fulfilling prophecy where every time an Exelon or another nuclear utility adds another 1,000-megawatt nuclear reactor, it's really the death knell for expanding the renewable sector of electricity in that state. This is one of the key reasons why Clinton 2 has to be defeated, because renewable energy will never get the market share it needs to reduce its costs through economies of scale if nuclear power plants are built.
We're down to our last 30 seconds. What would you suggest ordinary citizens do?
Fight like hell. And, you know, in my opinion, it's just not an ethical way to produce electricity. It is too big a risk. And citizens have to get involved. And it's not easy.
I need to thank our guests, Dave Kraft from the Nuclear Energy Information Service in Chicago. You could get more information about that from going to the website neis.org. And thank Alice Hurt from Holland, Michigan, for talking with us about nuclear energy issues today on Keeping the Faith.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for the program. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking about Communiversity, a local Champaign-Urbana a way for people to take classes for no credit, but at a very low cost. We'll be talking with Mike Kozar. At the University of Hawaii this week, we have our huge dump-and-run garage sale, attic sale, basement sale at the Stock Pavilion at the University of Illinois on Pennsylvania Avenue, just a couple blocks east of Memorial Stadium. That'll be starting this Thursday, August 24th at 2 o'clock till 9 p.m., and then Friday from 10 to 6, and Saturday in the morning from 9 till 12. Do stop by and get some real bargains. It's particularly encouraging. We want to particularly encourage international students to come, but it's open to anyone. $2 the first day admission, free after that. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Words like America and globalization often conjure up images of protest and conflict around the world. It's the U.S. versus them. Either you're for us or against us. But things aren't always so black and white. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, soap opera in China, hip-hop in Africa, and California wine in France. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Lorraine Theater in Hoopston, now showing A Prairie Home Companion. Directed by Robert Altman and written by Garrison Keillor, A Prairie Home Companion features Meryl Streep, Lily Tomlin, Woody Harrelson, and Kevin Kline as Guy Noir. Showtime's available on the web at lorrainetheater.com.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly clear with a low in the upper 50s and light winds. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, the high in the lower 80s with light winds. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low around 60 degrees and light winds. And Tuesday, mostly sunny with the high in the lower 80s and light winds. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.